Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, it's Amber Love of Vodka O'Clock Podcast from AmberUnmasked.com. Don't forget, we are an explicit website and podcast. So, if you're easily offended or under 18, you should probably not be here. And we might have some minor spoilers today, but I don't really think we're going to give away like the big reveal when I'm talking with Chris Kosak, who is the creator of the comic The Default Trigger. It's 54 pages full of conspiracy theories about student loan debt. So, welcome to Vodka O'Clock, Chris. Thanks for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, yeah, it is like we're kind of getting Chris here as he is like probably hasn't even unpacked his boxes yet after a big move.
Yeah.
having a baby, moving across the country, and all that stuff. So,
yeah, exactly.
So he's like kind enough to fit this into his schedule to talk about The Default Trigger. So let's get some background first so that people can just learn who you are, where you come from in comics, and you know, what brought you to this point where you made this really awesome creator-owned book.
Well, I'm a professional graphic designer. That's what I do for a living, and I've always been into comics since I was a little kid. I think like a lot of people, I have the spiral notebooks full of really awful kid comics that you draw that were just copying, you know, superheroes and stuff that were popular, you know, back in the day, and kind of went to art school and saw lots of different things and kind of put comics away for a while and was looking at other things and wound up and was working in the movie industry briefly and doing that and a whole bunch of things. And I decided to go back to design school and become a graphic designer. And from there, I was actually interning at an art book publisher called Passion. And as I was on the way out of the internship, I noticed there was this big book about DC Comics on their desk. And I was calling to the art director, like, oh, this is our next project. And I was like, oh, that's cool. I used to like comics, you know, before. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, I don't really know anyone who works here in the comics. Maybe you can help me on this, like a freelance thing. And it was a big 75th anniversary book that they did for DC. And it was like 1,000 pounds. But I started working on that with them. And that kind of slowly got me interested in comics again, looking at all these superheroes. And I started, before you know it, I'm at the store. I'm doing some quote unquote research. I'm buying comics and I'm picking up stuff and I'm reading them. And this is pretty neat. And then before you know it, I started listening to podcasts and seeing what's out there. And I started really getting into it. And I don't remember what happened at some point, but I was like, you know, I've always wanted to make comics. And I think, you know, with the design thing, kind of telling stories anyways, and maybe I should try my hand at it. And I just always had a lot of like storytelling that I wanted to get out there, and I was always looking for different places to do it, and it seemed like comics became a really good place to do all the things that I knew how to do, and then tell stories as well. I just kind of started making my own stuff and getting it out there, and here we are.
I love how you describe the crappy old notebook that everybody had in school. It was just one of those things where you could just doodling on anything. It was like, I can remember my sneakers being covered.
Oh yeah.
Your clothes, like my jeans would have things drawn on them, and then they would just go through the wash. It didn't matter. You draw on each other.
Yeah, I got in trouble because I was at Catholic school growing up, and I have these composition books that I use as my notebook, as my sketchbooks. And I was drawing some weird, you know, because you know, like a queen or whatever, you're drawing, sometimes can draw some weird, like, violent stuff. And I think one of the nuns saw it and got me all in trouble, called my parents in for a conference. It was all really awkward, like, why are these guys with axes and guns and blowing things up pictures? Like, can you draw nice things? Like, can you draw nice landscapes? I was like, I don't know, I'm a boy. I watch a lot of G.I. Joe. I don't want to draw pretty landscapes and things. But,
yeah, and that's just a very, really normal thing. I mean, I would I either drew cartoon characters like Snoopy or just doodles, like actual doodles, just little geometric spirals and triangles and just everything that just, you know, until you had an entire page covered and you know.
And like
sometimes
you
it can be really cool stuff.
Yeah, I remember we had to do like the, cover our school books in the brown paper. You know, like,
absolutely.
Cover those with all kinds of really badly, crudely drawn versions of superheroes and Bugs Bunny and whatever else I could think, and doodles, all kinds of random things. Whatever I could figure out how to draw, I was kind of trying to draw it. And so you know, you figure out how to draw like an airplane, and all of a sudden you have like 1,000 pages of airplane fighting because you can figure out the three triangles to make an airplane, you know, and you're happy because you can do that and it looks like something, you know, and then you figure out how to start drawing a little better.
Well, besides the nuns that weren't very happy with your artistic impressions, was there anybody that you had growing up that was actually really encouraging and supportive?
Yeah, it was kind of funny because when I was in ninth grade, I went to I got sent to an all boys Jesuit Catholic school for my first year of high school. My parents thinking that would be a good place to learn to discipline or to be safe, and it was like the worst place because you just had a lot of rich kids with lots of money. And so it became like a really kind of scary place. And so I didn't do well there. And so I wound up going to, my parents took me out of there and put me into public school, which we didn't know was like a pretty good pub, one of the best ones in the state where I grew up in Maryland. And, they had a really good art program there. The teacher at the time was this kind of nationally recognized, high school art teacher. And he had kind of, his name was Walt Bartman, and he prided himself on, he had all these sending kids scholarships to art schools and all these things, and he got some awards for his kids, and they had like an AP art program, and it was basically like studio art class, and it was kind of where the art kids hung out, but it became like a little bit of a clubhouse in the sense of like you would take your last two periods of the day in there, and before you knew it, you're just hanging out in this place, and it was really cool, and he was also really, really good at teaching art and very instructional. And so before you know it, I was doing that like all the time. I was going there. I was may have skipped classes and hung out there instead, you know, and with all the art kids, and you'd be doing things in class. And he ran like another workshop outside of the school. And so we go down there for like live figure drawing and classes in the summertime. And so it became this really like positive thing. And it wasn't so much about teaching us how to be artists, but I think he was teaching more about seeing and looking at the world around you, and he's like knowing that you're not all going to become artists when you grow up, but this is going to help you, and this is what he's really passionate about, and that kind of rubbed off. And I think that was the encouragement, like, you know, you could do this if you want to. We try to take anyone's skills and try to figure out ways to help them. What's also really cool is that you kind of find what you're interested in, and then you would find like maybe artists, like art history books that were like more towards your aesthetic. So if you were using like crazy bright colors, he might start showing you like Matisse or like Fauves, or if you were into like, you know, darker stuff, he'd show you some like old Albrecht Dürer etchings, and he could pretty much find anything, any kind of influence for anyone. So that was always pretty cool. And so I kind of developed a love of art history and things there. And that's kind of part of what got me out of comics in some way. It wasn't really like direct, but just seeing there was like more to art outside of, kind of what I was seeing on cartoons and comic books. And that was, to that point, my only real experience of anything kind of creative.
Well, I don't think I've ever heard of an AP art program before, because at least in my school, I don't remember hearing of that. We had AP maths and sciences.
We had all that too. Okay. But I think he somehow got this thing. He built this thing from nothing. And like every spring, we had like a big in the high school, like the auditorium, the gym. We would convert it into like this big art festival. We would have like everyone kind of get like almost like a science fair. You go like a booth and you put up your work and some the different levels. We had like ceramics classes and like the traditional kind of painting art studio classes and photography. And there would be like the theater kids would do their thing and music classes. And we had this big festival of the arts, and it was all this whole. It was an amazing thing, and I think he kind of started this. And it became a thing where everyone really, it became like such a cool thing to do, where everyone kind of wanted to be a part of that. It was kind of a cool thing to do, and so you wanted to get into that AP art class. You could then get a prime booth space when you were a senior, and like right in the front, and like show off your work, and it was like one of the cool things that I thought was perfectly normal, because that was my high school experience. And then I got out of there, like, I mean, every school didn't have a art festival, and didn't have a AP art that class, and that wasn't cool. It was like, oh, he's at football. That's interesting. So, yeah, it was fascinating.
Yeah, it sounds more like it.
It was a lot of public school, too, which was fascinating to me. So,
then, from high school, now let me actually ask you this, because you had brought up the figure drawing at that age. Some of the modeling that I've done was in a museum, so it was actually off campus. I don't know if the kids were getting any credit for being there, but it's one of those things where I feel like there's always got to be some sort of permission granted to see a naked body sort of thing. So what was that process like? Even though you were AP, you were still a particular age.
So it wasn't, it wasn't done in the actual high school itself, because that would have been kind of sketchy, you know. So what happened was there was a local community college that offered like the student art classes, and I think you worked out some kind of deal where we could go. I think you have to be either a junior or a senior, so I think at least 16 or 17 before you are allowed to do it. And then he worked out some kind of deal where like, on weekends usually they had open drawing sessions. And then he, worked on the deal. We could go there and do that. You pay a couple bucks for the model, and you could draw. And then he ran these workshops that were outside of the high school. And it was this really interesting place that I grew up in. It was the Washington, D.C. area. And there was this cool little place called Glen Echo Park that used to be this amusement park back, in the 20s. And they actually closed down because they didn't want to integrate. It was white people only, and they didn't want to let other people in. And they closed the whole park down. And they had roller coasters and public pools and all that stuff. And then it just kind of laid falling apart until the 80s, the 40s to the 80s, or the 50s to the 80s. It kind of just completely disintegrated. And the Park Service took it over and they started rebuilding it as this art colony kind of place where they would redo some buildings as art spaces and places to have classes. And he was able to rebuild this one thing as the studio / gallery. And so a lot of the high school kids, we have classes down there outside of schools, at night on weekends. And it's for continuing education kind of style. So you have adults and you have kids, and then there would be everything from still life and basic drawing classes. And then the more advanced level would be these figure drawing classes. And so that was kind of how that worked out. And then that and the community college stuff. Again, this was things that I thought were all kind of normal. And then they weren't really normal at all.
Yeah, it's really not. You have to really be in an environment where that's encouraged.
Yeah.
Because some areas just don't care about art. They think it's more like something extra as opposed to something vital to the community.
I think it's also the kind of neighborhood, the community I grew up in, where we had awful sports teams. Our high school football team hadn't won a game in 5 years. Our basketball team, our center was 6 foot tall, maybe. I think the one year we won was because we had a transfer student who was over 6'5", and we won. That was pretty much it. And I think we were really good at soccer and lacrosse, total suburban middle class kid sports, And that was about it. So as a result, the art became more valuable because I think a lot of the families were you go home, the houses were lawyers and doctors' kids are going to my public school. So it was a little more white collar parents as opposed to it wasn't the troubled high school, it's an inner city school or anything. So it was more of a suburban school. And so maybe that influenced us. I guess the arts were kind of valued and there was a lot of AP classes and going to college was really encouraged from the high school and a lot of my classmates. It was kind of a thing where, yeah, of course you're going to go to college after you go to high school. What else are you going to do? That's the thing you do. And so that was, again, I found out later, that's not a normal experience for a lot of high schools. So I guess looking back, it was kind of a really fortunate place. And I was able to get, I don't know if I would have fallen into creative stuff if it wasn't for that kind of, in those formative years where everyone's kind of lost and figuring their stuff out. Might have gotten to other things, who knows?
So if you were around people of all different ages while you had these opportunities to take workshops and classes and everything, what was it that kept you motivated and going as opposed to looking at different skill levels? Did you ever just get really down on yourself thinking, oh, I'll never be that good?
Kind of. I mean, it was kind of weird too because I was looking at a lot of fine art stuff. So a lot of art history books. Being outside of D.C., we have the National Museum of Art, so I would go there a lot. Field trips, some days I may have skipped school and gone down there instead and hung out with in the Picasso room or something, and just hung up down there, which again is not normal for a high school kid. But
no, it's really not. It's incredible though.
I was kind of really into it, and I was kind of looking at these influences and you see in books wow, there was a point in time where a lot of these artists weren't very good either at drawing. And I guess there was that push to I can do that. I guess when you're younger, you feel you can do anything. And maybe that's channeled into creative stuff. Like, you don't know what you don't know. And so you think, like, I can totally draw that good. I'm just going to do it. Like, you know, like, screw it. And so after a while, and you're nowhere close to being, like, as good as any of those guys, but you think you are and you think candy because you're young and you don't know any better. And then be part of that. But then also in these classes, too, you look like the older, like, retirees are taking classes just to take, like, art classes, you know. And some of them are like, oh, I used to be, like, an engineer, an architect, and now I'm retired and I'm painting still lives. And so it's kind of cool, like, to be around that. And I don't know, I think that also with your classmates and things, everyone's kind of, you're kind of in it together. You become friends, and it's very encouraging, and you're learning to talk to each other about your work and critiques. You're learning about critiquing, and you're learning about how to, like, see other cool things that people are doing and, like, kind of borrow techniques or borrow skills. Well, that's a cool way. That's a cool, you know, material you use or a cool process. And I think before you know it, it becomes this very, like, collaborative kind of, before you know, you're kind of collaborating and you work on your own projects. You're feeding off each other. And I think that's a big part of it too, I think. Yeah, that kind of peer support too.
So what, because I have no idea how old you are. So what time frame were you in, like, college in art, or in art school?
That was, like, the late 90s. I went to school. And then okay. In the 2000s, yeah.
Okay. So mainly because I was wondering about how the techniques, because you're a graphic designer, how, you know, that must be when you went to school versus, you know, somebody went to school in the 80s or whatever, you know, the whole computer technology is so different.
I went back for design later. So I went back, I only graduated about 4 years ago from, like, design school, you know, and went back. So it was already, the technology was already there. Kind of when I went around college the first time, there wasn't, graphic design, I guess, was still probably in, like, that weird analog, maybe just starting to get computers, and it wasn't as done, you know, and the whole kind of industry really changed in, I guess, around 2000, late 90s, 2000s, where people just, it was all computerized, you know, and all of a sudden it just started blowing up exponentially in terms of, technology and whatnot. But when I went back, you know, obviously you had all that stuff, and that was kind of, I stopped doing art and drawing for years when I was doing, like, I lived in LA for a while, and I was doing film stuff, working on set, and then doing design stuff again. I wasn't really drawing as much and doing art anymore, and I was focusing on this stuff, and you went through school and learned all about branding and logo, making logos and design stuff, and it was when I was there I started thinking, well, I was interested in comics and stuff too, and maybe I can pick it up again. I never really took it seriously until the last few years. And then I decided I wanted to do that as well.
So when you got to this point where we are now, we're talking about the default trigger is why we got together to talk today.
Sure.
And it's about student loan debt. So it sounds like you've done some, different tours through advanced education, if you will, you know.
Definitely.
And because I did as well. It's like I went for a bachelor's degree and then I went to massage school, and it was, I've taken, you know, like, training separate from that. It's just, everything just seems like perpetually in school and perpetually in debt.
Right.
it's so overwhelming. When did this really hit you?
Well, that's the thing. It's like pretty much everyone that I know went to some sort of post high school thing, whether you went to college or junior college or, like, a trade school, like nursing school, whatever, you went to some sort of post high school, training. And everyone that I know pretty much has had to take out loans to do it. And so, everyone kind of in my generation, you're having conversations, and if anything ever comes up about money, it's always like, well, I don't have any. And then you go, oh, student loans, you know, blah. And it's always like our biggest bill every month. And, like, everyone I know has that. My wife has it. I have it. Our friends have it. And it kind of doesn't matter what your job is. It doesn't matter if you're a doctor, lawyer, whatever. You still have these giant bills every month. That's probably one of your biggest bills. And it was getting on me because when I finished school, it was also around the time when all the banks imploded. And there was no jobs for anybody, especially just getting out of school. It was like, you know, 5 years experience for an internship kind of thing. That was a total buyer's market. And so it was rough to find things. And I was just freelancing here and there and had bills coming in. And it was so frustrating that all these banks that were, you know, you go to the student loan, like, fairs and they give you the brochures and the t-shirts and the free pens and stuff. And it's all fun. And yeah, we'll totally work with you. And we just want to help you. And we're here for you. And then you get out of school. It's like, yeah, you have to pay us right now. And, you know, you can't find a job. That's too bad. You still need to pay us. And, actually, in the beginning of the default trigger, that starts off with this dream sequence where he's kind of running from these bad guys. And there's, I guess, like a phone conversation of him talking with, it's supposed to be like with customer service reps. So those are all actual conversations that I've had with people, with loan officers or bank reps, where it's like, I was told, you know, I couldn't find a job and I was trying to get like some kind of deferment or something set up. And the guy's like, well, do your parents own a home? I'm like, yeah. Well, they should sell it and give you the money to start paying your loans back. I'm like, I'm not going to do that. That's stupid. I mean, I just want a few months break so I can find something here, you know? And it's like very like, you know, the one guy told me, you know, we have no obligation to work with you. And I was like, that's really awesome. That's not what I told. That's what the little brochure said. And so you get very upset and jaded where it's like, I mean, I'm not trying to get out of anything here. I just want like a shot to do this. Like, give me a chance. All the stuff just blew up, you know, and there's no jobs anywhere. And you hope for a little bit of understanding, but then it's your first dose of reality to the world here where, you know, big banking and big money, and you start getting jaded and angry and pissed off, and you're figuring out ways to pay your bills, and like you make all this money and then like it's gone as soon as you make it because you got a payment due, and it's huge. And I guess I started thinking about it, and you talk to your friends and you start reading articles and you start seeing like news stories, and you start seeing it like, I'm not the only person who has this. Oh, it's pretty much everybody who's graduated college in the past 20 years has this problem on some level, and it's only getting worse, and it's not really nothing's really making there are no solutions. Like we've identified there's a problem with it, but there are no real solutions being given. And it's, oh, it's too bad. And then you see, oh, and why won't the economy fix itself? Why aren't people buying houses and cars? Oh, because they have no disposable income because all their money's going to student loans. And so it's a very cause and effect thing. And I just started thinking about, this could be a cool story. I don't know what it could be, but there's something here. And I think I was starting to think about it for a couple of years, really. And then you read articles and see stories, and there's a lot of buzzwords that pop up. And one of them is always like slave to debt, like enslaved to student debt or just debt in general. And that terminology, slavery, kept popping up. And it's a bit of an exaggeration, but I guess that got my mind a little more and thinking, well, why is this generation of college graduates, really smart, intelligent, educated people, like, why would they need to be, like, slaved to debt for? How does that work out? Like, who would want to do that? And then, of course, you start thinking of, ooh, conspiracies. What could be some possible reasons as to why? Who could be behind that? And that's kind of, I think, a story started to grow out of that.
I love that you basically, like, addressed, like, the next two questions that I had, because it was, that's the fact that you created the default trigger, and we're going to talk about the elements that make up the story, but there's so much news that gets overlooked, or what you said is something that I noticed, is that nobody's talking about a solution that
right.
actually seems plausible. Everybody, like Elizabeth Warren, there was a great, I was reading in the Boston Globe this morning, it said Elizabeth Warren cites an official estimate that the government will gain $185 billion in profits from the loan program over roughly the next decade. But the same federal agency that produced that estimate also said it's just as likely, if not more so, that the government will lose $95 billion over that period. So it's like what we're getting is we're getting Elizabeth Warren, and then we're getting the people who are her opponents saying completely opposite things about where the interest of the student loans goes and who's really hurting. I mean, it sounds like some people are saying, oh, boo-hoo, the government's really hurting. We're really doing all we can. And then Elizabeth Warren, who was like, she should be wearing a cape and tights because
right.
she's our champion. And it's just amazing how they're looking at the same data. And data is fun. I used to be like in database management and stuff. Data is so fun because it's terribly boring, but it's fun in the sense that you can make it say anything you want to
say. Exactly. You always can. Yeah, totally.
And that's why you really can't believe a statistic that's out there.
Well, I kind of feel like the student loan crisis or bubble thing, we're treating it in a lot of ways like a check engine light on your car, where it's like, I'm aware there's some sort of problem. I'm not really seeing, my car's still going fine. It's good. I'm all good. You let it go for 6 months, and then one day your car doesn't start anymore. It's like, I wish I had a warning. I wish someone would have told me my car was screwed up. And then, you know, before you know it, boom. And it's been there the whole time, and we're not, yeah, like Elizabeth Warren, there's a few people out there that are kind of ringing the bells, as it were, and making a lot of noise about it. But I kind of feel like we're maybe a couple years away from something really big, like some kind of bubble or imploding or something, where a funny story where it's like, you know, I've talked to people that are like lawyers, like practicing lawyers and like engineers, right? And they all went to school for these things and have really good degrees and they're doing really good jobs. And they have their loans in good standing, and no bank will give them a home loan because they have too much debt. And I find that fascinating that like a lawyer can't get a home loan because
sickening, isn't it?
And it's weird that, like, in the bank's eyes, the garbage man down the street who may have, like, a felony conviction is a safer bet than the guy who went to law school and is practicing as a lawyer. Like, they don't want that guy the money. He sure isn't that guy. But the economy's kind of wasn't built around people with certain levels of jobs. You buy homes, you buy cars, and then vacations and all the discretionary income that kind of build the economy is built around the idea of people have good jobs and they spend money on things. And now all of a sudden, people with good jobs can't spend money on things. And it's like, well, we're all renting apartments and renting houses. And there's something wrong with that picture. And it's not healthy for, like, the basic economics. I don't think you need to be, like, have an advanced degree in finance to realize it's a bad situation. And maybe we're not there yet. But I think in the next few years, that's really going to maybe become a much bigger deal. And I think it's going to hit, like, the car industry and home industry and it's going to have to, because these people who traditionally have kind of been a really important part of the economy can't contribute to it, then where are we going to be?
Well, we're going to be in porn. It was just so funny that, you know, because I was reading the news this morning when I read, you know, that bit about Elizabeth Warren. And, of course, one of the headlines is about Duke University's Bell Knox porn star, and how she's on this crusade to validate her porn career as a viable means to pay for college, because Duke is very expensive. And, you know, it's one of those just cliche, laughable joke things that people always say when they go to a strip club is, oh, she's paying her way through college.
Right.
But it's a really big leap to go from, you know, G-strings and pasties in a strip club to, like, flying out to L.A. or Vegas and doing porn, like, you know, going under contract and doing porn. There's a really big difference there between a stripper and a porn star. And many of the critics that she's facing is, you know, like Huffington Post and Jezebel, like all these people are really kind of trashing on her. You know, she's sort of presenting it as like how empowering and how she's such a great feminist icon and everything at this point. It's like, you're still young. You still need to kind of shut up a little bit and learn.
Yeah, exactly.
But so they're saying that, you know, what she's doing isn't right because it's still a form of sexual slavery, that no one should have to abuse their bodies, take a cum shot to the face, or risk STDs just to pay for an education. And that is a really actual valid point. Where if you're doing it by just choice, like you think, I want to do this, this is a field I want to explore and go into, that's one thing. But the fact that this is being like you, it's not a norm. Like, I don't want to make it sound like every girl in college is doing this, but there's a lot more now with the presence of webcams everywhere. Like, every computer has a built-in webcam. And there's Chatterbait and there's MyFreeCams. And, I mean, there's all these really easy access tools for people to get online and make their own porn. And I was just wondering, like, what that says about job prospects and the viability of paying for education at this point. It's like, especially for women, you know, not exclusively for women, but especially for women.
Yeah, it's not like she goes to some rinky-dink community college. I mean, Duke's a really good school, and it's really hard to get into. So, like, she's a really smart person. And she felt somehow that her only option was to go out and do that. That was the best situation for her to pay for it. And that's a really kind of scary thought, that you know, that maybe, I mean, obviously, yes, she did choose to do that as, like, her after-school job for Bruins, but at the same time, it's like, that was her best opportunity, and that's kind of a really
scary
prospect.
But, I mean, there's a big difference. Yeah, there, I mean, it's like, do I go work at TGI Fridays for $2 an hour, you know, hopefully get some tips, or do I go do this on the weekends, you know?
The thing about, too, when you read, like, a lot of these articles, you read, you know, you don't read the comments. I read the comments a lot of times, and you'll see people being like, you know, back when I was in school, I used to deliver pizzas. Well, it's like, you're not paying for college delivering pizzas part-time anywhere. Like, that doesn't happen. And I think part of the reason why that is if you kind of read the deeper level of the articles, too, they talk about how college tuition has blown up, like, exponentially as opposed to, like, just general inflation. Like, college used to be it used to cost, say, as much as a pretty reliable used car, and now it's like buying a brand-new Mercedes. And so there's the level of, yeah, you used to be able to work 10 hours a week at a fast food place or doing burgers or whatever.
And you'd actually have something to speak of with your paycheck.
Yeah, but now when even like a state college is $10,000-$15,000 a semester or something, and you know, if you're in a particular industry where you have to go to certain levels of school, a lot of them are private schools, to do good, like you have to start losing $20,000-$30,000 a year easy, you know? And you're not making that kind of money delivering pizzas from a Navy at all. So it becomes like, how are you paying for that? And, you know, I mean, even at school, you all know the guy who gets busted for selling pot or whatever out of his dorm room. That happens a lot because they probably hatch you to pay for things, you know? And this is just another level of that in a lot of ways, you know?
Oh, there we go. There's a sequel.
Yeah.
for the default trigger will be the drug industry trade.
Right. That's why I thought that's like an old story. We all knew the dude on the floor. He was selling bootleg liquor in the Snapple bottles, or the guy selling pot. And that was pretty standard. Every school had that guy. But now I feel like it's like leveling up to like serious. You're gonna have like Walter White in like the college dorm pretty soon, you know.
Well, I went to a school that when we had about maybe it was less than 20 male students at the time, and half of them probably dropped out before we even got to graduation. So it's the school itself is totally different now, but it had been an all girls school until the year that I started. So I think our environment was extremely different.
Mm-hmm.
Like we didn't necessarily have the sorts of dangers, and it was a really, really tiny school. So, you know, when I see things like TV shows or movies or, you know, even in the news, like these kids at Seton Hall with guns, I'm like, that's Seton fucking Hall.
That's pretty
like,
scary.
How is that even possible? And it's just that my environment was so completely benign. I mean, there was some drugs that I heard of, like I never even saw them.
Right. Yeah. You knew they were around.
So it's interesting how from school to school, how an experience can be so drastically different. And when you were making the comic here, you don't talk about what the school system part of it was like. You're immediately into post grad. Let's face life. I'm home. I'm broke. I got to do something. And you get this phone call saying, I will take care of your debt if you do this 2-week job. But, you know, but here's the thing. You're not going to remember any of it.
Yeah. And that, if you get that phone call, you'd be like, that's really scary. But then at the same time, it's like you're getting dozens of phone calls from debt people and telling you your life is screwed and you're defaulting all this money and they're going to come after you. And it's like, at that point, you're just like, I guess this sounds like a good opportunity because it's so scary down the phone. I don't know.
The simple fact that if it was something criminal, like if it was 2 weeks doing something criminal, but you remember and you have the guilt and you have worry and you have shame and fear, all of these other possibilities that would normally prohibit somebody from taking a deal like that.
Right.
But instead, you at least brought up this caveat saying, oh, but you won't remember.
Yeah, I can do anything for you. Anything.
I can't imagine anybody saying no to this.
Yeah, because, I mean, there would be – but also the fear thing would keep you from wanting to do it. Like if someone said, you know, all you have to do is, like, you're going to go rob a bank or something with me, right? And it's risky, but you might do it, but you might not, because you might be scared. Like, well, I don't want to go to prison, because I'm like, I'm just a short white guy. I'm not going to do well in prison. I'm not going to risk it, you know? But if they're like, well, you can't remember what you're going to be used for. That could be lots of really scary things. You have no idea. Are they going to send you off to kill people? Are they going to do experiments on you? Are they going to take out your organs? What are they going to do? And why? Why is it so important that you're not allowed to remember? That even makes it more scary, I think. And so I thought that was an interesting thing too, because it kind of played into this idea of, if this is happening kind of in the world, and no one will be talking about it because no one can remember what they did to fix their problem. And I thought that would be an interesting kind of way to set up the bad guys and the things that happen.
Well, is the book available right now?
It is. I've got it on my website right now. Yeah, I kind of did it as a free / pay what you want kind of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, because I just wanted to get it out there, and I want people to see my work, and I thought that could be kind of a fun way to do it. And it's been getting pretty good feedback doing it that way. Yeah, if you ever right on my website, it's just my name, ChristopherKosek.com, and you can find it there.
Because I'm really interested in if we can get like a Twitter dialogue going about would people take the deal or not. Yeah, we need to hashtag default trigger, and get that running. So I want to talk about the feel of the book, the visual feel to it, because you've, like I said, you've already got your character after school, and he's desperate. So you've really limited the colors, the color palette, and you've got like these big shaded black ink areas, which I love because the type of books that I read generally need that. They have that suffocating noir and suspense feel. And with you, you've got conspiracy theories, you've got some science fiction, you've got a little bit of cyberpunk feel to it. So I was wondering how you, like as an artist, how did you decide the tone, the textures, and the color palette to choose what was right for this book?
So on this book too, I guess to mention, like, I did everything on it myself. I wrote it. I did the art, I did the lettering, all the stuff on it. And knowing that, it's just kind of out of necessity, because I always have difficult to find, you know, collaborators when you're kind of starting off. And so when I was kind of being a designer and I worked as an art director, one of the things that's really important is you have to justify kind of your budget and your time versus what you can do. Right, because it doesn't really matter if you come up with the coolest idea in the world. If it costs $1 million and you only have $5,000, that's a useless idea. So you have to figure out what's possible. And so for me, I was like, well, I've got a full-time job, I've got a wife, I've got a baby at home, and I want to do this comic. What can I do? And I have no money to hire anybody. What can I do? I have, maybe if I'm lucky, an hour a night before I have to fall asleep. I have a lunch break, but that's about an hour. And that's about it to work on this thing on a daily basis. So then I start thinking about, well, this is a darker kind of, it's got a noir feel to it. So then that means, like, well, I can draw huge, big black areas, and that'll be kind of creepy and mysterious, but it also means that I don't have to, like, draw really detailed stuff in. I can kind of hide things in shadows and work in shadows, which I wanted to do anyways to get work conceptually. And then for, like, the color of this, I had this greenish kind of, it's kind of three colors, black, there's white of the paper, and then there's this green color, which I kind of used as an all-around kind of like a middle tone. And I kind of felt like, well, you know, green's always that creepy kind of color of like the fluorescent lights, but it's a little darker than that. But I kind of wanted to give it something, a little more dimension. Just a black and white book wasn't enough. I wanted to give it that extra color. And again, it came down to, well, I can give it, I think just that one color can really push it to a different level visually, and it won't take me 12 hours a night to do a fully rendered colored page with like Photoshop, and that takes a lot of time. And so I was really thinking about, but how can I get this done in a few months and not have to spend 8 hours a day drawing it? And because I just thought that time didn't exist for me.
What influences did you have from other comics that you read that really inspired you to make those decisions?
I look at a lot of stuff. Like, you know, like a lot of indie like the indie self-published or kind of like the zine level comics have that one color. They use like this one light, like a light blue color is used a lot. Like Jeff Lemire.
That's really awesome. Like,
yeah, like Jeff Lemire.
I was thinking of Dean Tripp's new book, Something Terrible. He did that.
One of my favorite books is Jeff Lemire, the one called The Nobody, I think. It's The Invisible Man, kind of retold. But he does that.
Oh,
he does that
okay.
with this blue color as a. It's really cool. Seems to be through Vertigo. It's really kind of neat book, and it's just black and white with this kind of blue, light blue, middle tone color. And it's amazing how much depth and all you can create with just this one color. With just, you know, traditional ink and stuff. And so that was kind of an influence. But then I was looking at like other black and white kind of art, things like, you know, Sin City, where he uses heavy blacks and he's kind of carving things out of the black as opposed to drawing. He's not really drawing shadows as much as he's drawing light, you know. And then you look at other guys like Brian Wood, his earlier like Channel Zero. I don't know if you know that book, but that was kind of.
I don't know that one. No.
It was one of his earlier projects, like, kind of out of school. It had this like this zine, kind of Xerox, heavy black kind of aesthetic. It's about like mass media and that kind of stuff. But that was a super heavy, dark kind of look to it, which is kind of neat. And then looking at a whole bunch of other guys that were looking heavily in like in black and white, and then looking with like all the guys working with like limited palette stuff, and kind of looking to seeing how they did it and figuring out, is it possible to do a finished looking comic that isn't full Photoshop, fully rendered? Is that possible? And I was like, yeah, it's possible. These guys did it very well, so maybe I can borrow some ideas from there.
There's a great collective of guys called Comic Twart, where they're like Ron Salas and I think Gabe Hardman's part of it, Steve Bryant and Francesco Francavilla. It's so cool because they all have a similarity in style, but yet they're all very distinct.
Right.
and that's they really have the perfect mastery of the heavy dark inks and the white of the paper.
Right.
It's amazing to see, because when I've sat through an art class and they talk about draw the negative space, don't draw the object that you're looking at. It's not that I didn't understand what they were saying. Like, I knew what was being said, but I couldn't figure out how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it makes sense to you, like, in a as, like, words, as, like, a lesson, but then as a practice, it's a little bit different to figure that out, to see it.
And some people just, like, they kind of just get it right away.
Well, I think graphic design really influenced how I did things, too, because of thinking about that kind of stuff, where you know how ink works on paper, and you're understanding things about, positive and negative and that white space and filling things up with ink versus letting the paper breathe and all these things that are kind of, I'm doing like a brochure for a healthcare system, but I'm using some of the same kind of thinking to do that as I am drawing a comic in a lot of ways too.
You know what did it for me, I think, that finally made it real and made it actually work? Because I'm not an artist. I don't draw. I'm terrible. But I do pumpkin carvings. And you're working. When you're pumpkin carving, you're doing the negative.
Yeah, totally.
So I would have to take a picture that somebody else drew, and I would take it into Photoshop, and you sort of like, you know, posterize the layers and bring down the threshold so that there's only, you know, three or four possible shades. There's the shade you completely cut out. There's the midtone that you partially cut out, and then there's the flesh of the pumpkin that's going to stay. And that's the one exercise that I ever figured out in negative space.
That's hard. I'm not good at pumpkin carving, so I've never been good at that. That's tricky because you get from the negative, then you got to figure out what you're going to need to like connect it all together, you know?
Yeah, it has to always connect or you're going to lose pieces through the middle.
Yeah, when I was like 10, I was like, why did it fall out? I was like, oh, because you didn't leave anything.
Yeah. But now you have a child to raise, so I imagine there will be crafts like pumpkin carving in your future.
Yeah, thank God for like YouTube and Google. I can figure all this stuff out through there. I can like watch tutorials and how to carve a pumpkin, you know? I have no shame. Like I'm YouTubing things like how do you adjust a baby, like a child's seat in a car? Like I'm doing all this stuff. I'm just like, I don't know how to do anything without YouTube or tutorials, you know, instructables on
I'm sure
all
there's
this
an
stuff.
There's got to be an instructables.
Yeah, how to change diaper? Like, I don't know.
So yeah, well, because it's your first,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Okay, so then if you have any more,
I figured it out pretty fast. I was like, "What do you do? This is complicated."
It is. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So, what other projects are you presently working on, or is there anything that you could talk about in the future that, you know, it's 2014, but we're like already a quarter in at this point. So, what can people look forward to?
Well, I think right now, until I finish moving, I'm kind of putting this a whole lot of moving. I'm doing a lot of writing right now because I don't have the space to draw and do a lot of stuff. But right now, I think my goal for the next year is to start doing more collaborations. I kind of did all the drawing in my early work because I kind of had to. I wanted to get work made to show people that I can make a comic. But I think I'm trying to push more of the writing and the design angle than, say, the art angle, whereas like I'm kind of getting away with art. I know it's a little rough, but there's a lot of people who are much better than me, and I want to work with them. So right now I'm doing a lot more I'm trying to do a lot more collaborations. I want to kind of go backwards a little bit and do some more shorts, like, you know, 6-pagers, 4-pagers.
I love them. They're so fun.
Yeah, they're fun. They're hard too. I think that's
They're hard to finish a story.
It seems like it would be easy because it's only like 4 pages, but to tell a complete story where you care about a character and then there's a twist or something at the end to kind of sell it, that's very difficult to do that. And I kind of learned that the hard way. And so I'm writing some things about that. Most of my stuff I'm interested in tends to skew towards like the sci-fi or like the supernatural side. I think that's just the childhood group watching the X-Files and going to Catholic school. Those two things right there can kind of explain that, I guess. So doing that, I've got one that hopefully when the artist can get a chance, he's going to jump in this. It's about two guys in a bunker. So things happen and it's creepy. So there's that, coming soon, hopefully. And I've got, I'm working with, Grey Haven Comics. Do you know those guys?
Yeah, I know them.
Yeah, so they're really cool, and they're really cool in that, like, I submitted to their open calls, and I've got a couple projects through there that they have really long lead times, so I've been writing and working on these, like, little 4-page shorts and getting a few things going with that, and that's really exciting, because I think it's really cool that, like, it's as much opportunity as there is in comics, there's not always an opportunity, like, when you're just starting to get, like, your work out there. So they're really cool in that their model is built around on more up-and-coming talent and getting people chances, and that's pretty cool. So doing stuff with that. I've got one about, like, a supernatural thing about a girl in therapy, so that's scary. And then I've got one about I did a first-person perspective, kind of a male perspective, when my son was born, and, like, all the freak-out that happens on, like, not knowing what's going on but still having to be the supportive person, and like, how do you freak out on the inside by being supportive on the outside? And that's kind of scary. I've never seen a story written about childbirth from the dad's perspective before, so that was kind of something I wanted to do. So those are kind of some things I'm working on right now. I'm writing other things. I'm trying to figure out like a longer term, like a mini series that I've been writing. I'm taking my time with it, really embracing the full script writing, the revision process, and that's more of like a post-apocalyptic kind of thing, but really trying to develop characters and create an interesting story and creating all the stuff that I want to get in there and really taking my time with it.
Well, now that you've moved and you have a baby to worry about, are you changing plans for convention season at all?
Yeah.
Are you just like,
I really wanted to go to Emerald City this year, but I actually got laid off before like the holidays or on the holidays, and so that kind of changed my plans. And so like, I just found a new job, so we're kind of starting over. So obviously any plans to go to conventions, that was put on hold. So now maybe wait till next year to do that. And kind of not thinking about probably not for the summer because of, like, you know, all the moving and stuff, and that's going to be just crazy. So I think that probably have to wait till, like, you know, the winter or maybe the next summer, which sucks, but I want to do that. I've only really been to like small regional cons, so I want to go to some of these bigger ones, and that's where all the cool kids hang out and do all the cool meeting and networking, and you meet all your collaborators and get off Twitter, and that's the place to be. So I want to do that really soon.
Well, that's cool. Hopefully, you know, I don't know if we'll ever run into each other because you're on the West Coast now.
Yeah, I'm going to be in the San Francisco Bay Area, so.
Okay. Yeah, I doubt I'd be heading that way. But it would be great if I was.
You never know. These comics are a small enough world where you run into people, so.
You do. That's what's pretty cool, you know, is that there are opportunities to run into people. And that's why the conventions really are important, because even though we network and email and Twitter and all
right.
of this stuff, you know, it's just nice to be able to blow off steam after the convention and just, you know, everybody saddles up to the same bar and
yeah.
you're exhausted and, you know, you just really get to know each other without the stress of the show.
And it's much different when you know someone like as a name and a face that you've hung out with as opposed to just like an avatar.
Right.
You know, it's just
yeah,
really
absolutely.
Different.
Yeah, you can establish a real connection and a relationship. And when you're looking for collaborators, it's really important that you have a good communication process between each other.
And I think with anything creative too, like some of you're going to learn a lot of creative stuff just from like the conversations in the cafe or the, but it's the oldest story in the book of like how many great art movements have started in a bar or a cafe. I mean, pretty much all of them. So, I mean, you think of like all the creative people, every generation, that's where the ideas are exchanged. It's just people coming together, talking about stuff that's going on. That's where you're probably like, who knows, like, I go to one of these cons and I meet people, all my Twitter friends, and we're talking about stuff, and I come out of there with like 1,000 new ideas for new stuff that I want to do and new ways of thinking about stuff. And that's kind of the exciting thing that I guess would look forward to the most, is that what you would bring back with you that wasn't like physical merch, but all the cool experience and the stuff you learned coming back from there.
That's true. It is reinvigorating, you know,
yeah.
especially if you've had a long winter and you just sort of are a little bit defeated. You get re-energized when you're around other people who become excited about projects. It's like, yeah, I want to be excited about this project too. And
yeah.
and all of a sudden the energy feels like it's back.
And
that's really
secretly,
important.
And while you secretly nervously listen to all the creator-owned like announcements, like, no one better announce my idea that I've been working on for the past 2 years. No one better do it.
Exactly.
You're
yeah.
really excited about it. Incredibly nervous that someone's going to come up with close enough. You know?
Oh, no. Somebody else did a comic about student loan debt. Oh, no.
Well, it was part of the reason why I released it when I did it. It's like, well, convention season's starting. So at least if someone announces it, I can say I had mine out before you even announced it. So you can't say anything about that. You know, I got it out there. And I'm always paranoid about, like, what if – I've been working on this for forever, and someone is like comes up, you're doing that book at Image. I'm like, great, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
You know, I can't do it. You know, but maybe someone else out there, there's some creator that's like secretly cursing under his breath because they have that pitch and I ruined it for him. I don't know. Maybe not.
There's always another story to tell.
Yeah. And
yeah.
I forget what creator said it, but it's like if that happens to you, then that means you were kind of pushing along the baseline of the zeitgeist. You weren't going far enough to make it special if it's someone else has your idea, you know? And that kind of makes sense if you think about it.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, there's there's a million zombie stories and,
exactly.
you know, a million superhero stories, and everybody has the opportunity to put their own point of view and, you know, what they're going to do too. And you've got a twist and, like I said, conspiracies in yours. So, you know, it's unlikely somebody would duplicate it exactly.
I think it would be really cool if, like, one of the reasons why I did this, too, like, I kind of thought about how, you know, art and literature and all those things, they've always talked about the issues of their day in their stories, whether, you know, it's something that's very apparent, something that's very hidden within subtext and meaning. And this is one of the biggest issues right now going around for people, like, if you're like under 40 pretty much, and if you graduate college in the past 20 years, it affects you, you know someone who it affects you. So why have I never really seen any of this appear? I've never seen it like really come out like this in like TV, movies, books, nothing that I'm aware of, comics. Not seeing this story anywhere, but it's affecting everyone. So I kind of wanted to do that as a story. And I think it would be really cool if this became like a subgenre of people doing every kind of thing about these sorts of problems, these real world issues that are kind of affecting us. And I guess, yeah, like how you make, it's hard to make student loans interesting, but figuring out twists and things that, and I think one guy actually told me he's expecting it to be some just some sad, mopey thing about woe is me, I can't afford my loans, you know, I have 5 jobs, and it wasn't about that. And I was really surprised that you did something interesting with that. So yeah, that was my goal. So I think sometimes, you know, with comics, we can get, thinking about all those crazy, like, cosmic things or crazy things that are happening. And sometimes there's, like, a story, like, right in your lap that's, like, in your life right now that could be interesting. And I guess that's where the write what you know comes from, but they don't necessarily mean, like, it doesn't have to be autobiographical. It can just be, like, take that little slice of life right outside your window and you can do something cool with it.
There's one other creator that I know who takes some things like this, who takes some social issues, and he's out of the UK. His name is Daryl Cunningham, and the book that I read was called Psychiatric Tales, and I loved it. And what's funny is he has a similar premise. Like, his inks are not as noir as yours, but he does a very simple palette. And his figures are very, like, more cartoony. Like, everything's very, very simplified. And you can tell, like, the way that the buildings are drawn, there's, you know, it's windows, but no details, that sort
right.
of thing. And, you know, so he takes on the medical community. He takes on Ayn Rand, and he does these stories, you know, in a similar sort of vein, but he keeps everything very real. Whereas
yeah.
I like how you're sort of taking the speculative fiction approach. And, you know, and saying, like, hey, there's this technology might not really exist, or maybe it does. We don't know, but I'm putting it in my story.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't want to become, like, I know there's those types of stories that are really, like, activist, you know, and that isn't necessarily my, like, I watch maybe more news than I should, and I'm aware of the stuff, and I see things, and, like, I don't want to be, like a fist in the air activist guy, you know, but I kind of also want to make commentary on stuff that's happening. And so I felt like you can do that. You can have a little fun with some completely crazy fictional things, but still talk about contemporary issues. And yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff out there. So I think there's so much you can do. But yeah, it is kind of interesting to see kind of generation, what they call millennials, whatever the name is for it, but like we get this rap as being like kind of lazy and entitled and don't care about anything. But like, I think people care about a lot of stuff. They're just maybe, you know, it's maybe now it's coming out as apparent in some of the art and the writing. Maybe it is, but I think there's room to do it.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for taking the time out of your crazy changing schedule. And you know, I know that you're going through all these adjustments with your
yeah.
new life and everything. So thanks so much. It's been great.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you for having me. I definitely appreciate that you wanted to talk to me on your podcast about it. That was really cool.
Yeah, I was so glad that you hit me up on Twitter because, you know, we had been following each other for a while and everything.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, new story, absolutely. And, you know, like I said, guys, it's called The Default Trigger. It's 54 pages with the conspiracy theory style. So once again, Chris, shout out your website and your Twitter handle so that people can follow you.
So my website is my name. It's ChristopherKosek.com. You can find pretty much everything, all my design stuff, all my comic stuff on there. And then I'm on Twitter. It's this @CKosek. I'm on there a lot. You can talk to me. I'm nice. I think I'm funny. Probably not. But I talk to people. Yeah, so that's pretty much where to find me. There's two main places.
Well, thank you so much. And, guys, you can, of course, follow me at Elizabeth Amber on Twitter and everything else. Like, the show notes for this episode are at amberunmasked.com. And, you know, once again, I think it'd be a really fun idea if we could hashtag default trigger and talk about whether or not you would take the deal of taking a secret 2-week job if it paid off all of your student loans, but you had no memory of what you did during that time. So let's get that rolling.
That'd be good. I'm going to hashtag that. Hashtags only work, though, if people, like, use them. So it becomes, like, you know, the sad, lonely hashtag that no one uses.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that'd be kind of interesting. Would you do that?
Would you do that? I think that's, you know, now that when the episode's out, I think that's something we should get rolling on and see how many people are brave enough to do it.
would you do it, Amber?
I think I would, as long as I had no memory of it. Yeah, I probably would have done it.
Why don't I have a pancreas like 6 to 10 years later? Why don't I have lungs anymore?
Yeah, but it's one of those things where I'm like, you know, kind of in a different situation. Like, I don't have a family to worry about. Like, if I'm gone
yeah.
for 2 weeks, you know, it's like, if something dreadful happens to me, it's like, okay, my parents will be upset. Maybe I don't even think my cat would miss me. Like, you know, I really have like a lot less to lose than perhaps somebody else, somebody like you. You've got a wife and baby, you know, so it's a really different scenario. And that would definitely take things into consideration for people. I think they would weigh that.
Would your friends notice if you weren't on Facebook or Twitter for 2 weeks? I think some people might not notice, but that would be weird, yeah. You know, like how do they fix that? There's all kinds of things, like, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Chris. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And be sure to send your feedback. Let us know how you liked the episode. Cheers.
Thanks. Bye.